Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll talk with Daniel Geary, author of a new book about C. Wright Mills, about that radical sociologist's thought and career. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from the Harvard economist Claudia Golden about the gender gap in elite professions and the career hit that women take for having a kid. First, just a few words on the economic news. People in the markets were pleasantly surprised to hear Robert Gordon, a member of the National Bureau of Economic Research's Business Cycle Dating Committee, the official arbiter of recessions in the U.S., say the other day that from the behavior of the unemployment insurance claims, it looks like we can see the beginning of the end of the recession. Listeners to this show have been hearing this from me for several weeks. Specifically, I've pointed out that if you look at the yearly change in the weekly number of people filing for first-time claims for unemployment insurance benefits, that measure usually peaks about a month or three before a recession comes to an end. We started seeing signs of that peak in March, and the numbers continue to support that impression. Last week's decline of 13,000 in the number of first-time filers was the second consecutive decline and the sixth in the last 8 weeks. But, and this is an important but, the number of so-called continuing claims, that is, the count of people who remain unemployed and continue to draw benefits, that keeps rising. So the pattern I've been also talking about here for several weeks continues. The rate of job loss is slowing, but the rate of hiring remains stuck in the doldrums. Still, the trend in initial claims is some of the best real-world news we've heard since the recession began in December 2007, and it suggests to me that the economy may start turning around in the fall. It's not likely to be a boom, but it will stop circling the drain, I think. We're also seeing a pickup in surveys of consumer attitudes. These aren't always reliable. If people hear things are getting better in the news, well, then they repeat that back to pollsters. So it may not be a deeply held belief based on personal experience or rigorous research. But the gloom is lightening somewhat. Yes, most of the pickup in the sentiment figures reflects improved expectations for the future rather than bouncier evaluations of the present, and yes, the upper income bracket is getting more hope-filled than those below them. But we're also seeing improvement in consumers' perceptions of the job market. Gradual, small improvements, but again, at least they're positive numbers. A potential wrinkle, though. The bond market took a big hit this week on fears that all the borrowing the government is doing to fund bailouts and stimulus programs is going to give the bond market some serious indigestion. Yeah, you have to say this is news to you, Mr. Smarty Pants Bond Market. You just figured this out. But if long-term interest rates just keep rising, the recovery is going to get a lot harder to mount. And since mortgage rates are tied to long-term treasury bond rates, any serious rise in interest rates is going to knock the housing market for another loop, which is something it really can't handle. Prices are still falling, and sales are still creeping along the bottom. And as the Mortgage Bankers Association reported earlier this week, delinquencies and foreclosures continued to rise in the first quarter of 2009 from already record levels at the end of 2008. Over 9% of all mortgages are now past due, and almost 4% are already in foreclosure. That translates into about 11 million people past due and 4 million or 5 million in foreclosure. That's a tremendous human toll, and you've got to guess that about that many more are at the edge of this sort of thing. And since these numbers tend to rise even if the economy starts to recover, we're not likely to see any improvement in the housing crisis for at least a year. And since I'm expecting the unemployment rate to continue to drift higher even after a formal recovery begins, housing problems could easily continue into 2011. Cheerful. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Daniel Geary.
Thank you.
That was a bit of Beethoven's Sonata No. 31 for piano, first movement, performed by one of my musical heroes, Alfred Brendel. Okay, first interview today is with Daniel Geary, author of Radical Ambition, an intellectual biography of C. Wright Mills, just published by the University of California Press. Geary teaches at Trinity College Dublin, but he was in New York a few weeks ago, so I nabbed him for an interview about this great sociologist. Daniel Geary. Welcome, Daniel. Let's start by dispensing with a couple of myths about Mills, one that he was a maverick and that he was deeply American in some profound sense. First of all, the maverick bit. How much of a loner was he, really?
Well, Mills has this image, which in part he created. I mean, he famous for riding a motorcycle. He wore a leather jacket, and this was the 1950s, so academic attire was a lot more formal at the time. And for that reason, people thought him as a sort of maverick, as a lone wolf, as a single rider who, you know, was a voice against Cold War complacency. But the fact is that Mills was very much a part of his time. He wasn't certainly the only leftist around, and he had other connections with others in the 40s, 50s, into the early 60s. And the other thing is that he developed many of his ideas within the university setting, and even shared some ideas with some liberals with whom he had famous debates. But if you look closer, the way in which they saw the world was very similar, even if they had different evaluations of it.
Yeah, I want to get back to all that later. But what about his Americanness, too? Did he have connections to European thought, or was he really a product of a pure product of our native strain?
Well, part of the myth about Mills is that he came from Texas. He was born in Waco, Texas, moved around there, went to school at the University of Texas, and spoke in a Texan drawl. He had a grandfather who was a Texan rancher who had been shot to death, and he loved to tell people in New York about this story. So he loved to play this part of the Texan as well. And people have picked this up and said, well, Mills was a particularly American thinker, and his radicalism was somehow especially American. And in the 1960s, after McCarthyism, this was a very appealing idea to people, that somehow you could have an Americanism that was, or a radicalism, that is, that was particularly American, that wasn't a foreign import. But the fact is that Mills was very influenced by European thinkers from the get-go, Max Weber in particular. At the end of his life, he did a lot of traveling to Europe and to Latin America and was very influenced by events going on there as well. One of the things I tried to say in my book is that Mills was certainly influenced by particular American traditions, but he was also very much connected to developments in the rest of the world as well.
All right, let's do a little biographical scene setting. You said he was born in Waco, Texas. Tell us about his family and his early years.
Well, his father was a salesman, insurance salesman, so the family traveled around a great deal. Mills, from an early age, was attracted to sort of a scientific, rationalistic way of viewing the world. He wasn't a radical at a young age, but he had a Catholic upbringing, and he rejected that early on. Went to university first at Texas A&M, which at the time was a military school, which he absolutely hated. And after one unhappy year there, moved to the University of Texas, which in Austin, Texas, was a very cosmopolitan place within Texas. And Mills had a lot of professors who came from the University of Chicago. And it was at Texas that he really connected up with these sort of wider intellectual traditions that would make his career.
And then how did he find his way up to New York City?
Well, New York, he went around, he got his PhD at Wisconsin, then had a job at University of Maryland, and was hired at Columbia in 1945, came up there to work actually in a research bureau, the Bureau of Applied Social Research, which is interesting because later on Mills became famous as someone who criticized the obsessive use of statistics in sociology. But his first job, which brought him to New York, was actually in a research bureau.
Yeah, let's talk about the late 40s a bit. This was a period when it looked like American labor, the American labor movement was alive after its World War II torpor, and Mills was associated with that, and he had some hopes for it, in contrast to his later turn, perhaps. Tell us about his work as a labor researcher.
Yeah, he was very closely connected to labor in the mid to late 1940s. During World War II, he became a radical, but was very pessimistic about any chances for social change and pessimistic about labor. But there was this extraordinary moment after World War II, a massive strike wave, massive amounts of unionization, and Mills was closely connected to that. His first book, in fact, was The New Men of Power, was about American labor leaders. And he had a lot of hopes for labor that was sort of quickly dashed. I mean, this mid to late 40s was a very important period for labor relations, obviously get the Taft-Hartley Act, where unions become playing less of a political role and more of a sort of role, an economic role. But there was a moment there where it seemed like a different kind of social order could emerge.
He also did some survey research in Middle America about the spread of opinions and thought leadership and that sort of thing for, of all things, for a men's magazine, right? Tell us about that research.
Well, he did some research that was then published, and it had to do with the famous – this is what he was hired to come to Columbia for the Bureau of Applied Social Research. They had a project to look at how opinions were formed in Middle America. And Mills was working under the Bureau's director, Paul Lazarsfeld, and they had a very famous conflict about this, which led Mills to become quite alienated from professional sociology. But the interesting thing is Mills was interested in using these sort of new opinion techniques to find out how opinion was shaped, and he even wanted to use it sort of for the labor movement, to use these techniques to say to unions, oh, here's how you can use public opinion research and marketing methods to try to recruit union members.
Opinions were not sort of injected directly from the mass media into the heads of individuals. This is the argument, right? How did they spread?
Well, the idea that that Lazarsfeld had is that you had certain opinion leaders. So, the relationship of the mass media to individuals was highly mediated by certain leaders in different communities who would sort of tell their friends what to buy or, you know, what shows to see or what have you. And, Mills, in this sense, was able to sort of have a view that wasn't the standard sort of mass society point of view. But on the other hand, when this view was taken to look at politics to say that, it was really a democratic society in which individual local leaders had the power. That wasn't a view that Mills could stomach, and it led to in large part to the controversy between him and Lazarsfeld.
Yeah, these ideas were a little too horizontal for him, right? Spread among more or less equals, and he is very interested in the hierarchies of power and how that related to opinion formation. Right?
That's exactly it, yeah.
What were his relations with some of the intellectuals of the late 40s, early 50s? The Partisan Review crowd, and Dwight MacDonald, and all these people dropped their previous radicalism and came to an accommodation with liberalism, the American order. How did Mills fit into that?
Well, Mills was a part of that scene. I think never fully an insider, but Dwight MacDonald was a good friend of his. It was Mills that suggested the title for Politics Magazine, a very small magazine that MacDonald was the editor of. Lowercase p, that's right. And the idea that Mills had is that Mills was already frustrated that a lot of the Partisan Review crowd were losing the radicalism, were sort of going into this sort of existentialism and losing their politics. And Mills thought, let's have a magazine that's about politics, like the old Partisan Review used to be. But quickly, MacDonald went down that path as well. And Mills, interestingly enough, is one of the few people who manages to continue to hold radical beliefs into the late 40s, early 50s.
But then the American labor movement must have disillusioned him at a point. So what happened to his politics as after the great capital labor accord of 1949? How did Mills evolve from that?
Well, from there, Mills retained his radicalism, but his radicalism had a highly, what I call, a disillusioned character. That is to say that he retained radicalism as a stance of social critique, but he didn't see any chances for radical politics actually emerging out of the American social order. And this gives his radicalism a highly pessimistic character, in some ways quite similar to Frankfurt School intellectuals with whom Mills also had close connections.
That's not very American, is it?
No.
Oh, that kind of pessimism isn't really very American either, is it?
No. And I mean, of course, some of the sources of that, influenced, as I mentioned before, by Max Weber, and he takes a sort of idea that the modern world has an inherent tendency toward bureaucracy, which is destined to sort of crush individual freedom and substantive reasoning.
One of his early major books, White Collar, actually had some crossover appeal as a trade publication. What was his argument in that, and how was it received?
Well, White Collar was written in this moment of the late 1940s with this rapidly shifting politics, and it was a book about what Mills called the new middle classes. So we saw a shift from sort of old middle classes of independent professionals and farmers and small businessmen to people who basically, you know, were employees of one sort or another. And so Mills looked at these employees and he saw sort of what was going on was a increasing sort of de-skilling of work, an increasing hierarchy, so that white-collar workers increasingly lacked control over the work that he did. And he compared this to an ideal of craftsmanship, which he saw, you know, in which workers had control over the work that they did. And he saw this ideal continually disappearing in the modern world.
Then, of course, there's a book that came out in 1956, which is, of course, in accord with some of my current obsessions, The Power Elite. give us a, you know, the quick sketch of what that's all about and how that fit into the thinking of its time.
Well, Mills argued that the United States was ruled by what he called a power elite, and this was an interlocking set of political, economic, and military leaders. So Mills was arguing against what he saw as the sort of naive Marxist view that it was simply an economic class that ruled, and wanted to say that no, political and military leaders actually have an important influence on decisions as well. And it was these leaders, Mills argued, that made the important decisions about the United States, the decision to drop the atomic bomb, to enter World War II, to create a certain kind of mixed military Keynesian economy after World War II. And this kind of point of view was not one that was widely expressed in post-war America. I mean, most liberals argued that the United States was a democratic country, and typically the U.S. was contrasted with the Soviet Union, where the U.S. was a free democracy. And Mills said, no, the United States, in fact, is not a democracy. It is ruled by a power elite. And for that reason, it was a very controversial book.
But it was noticed and actually got fairly good reviews in a lot of cases, right?
It was quite noticed, and it wasn't dismissed out of hand as much as we might see. So it did get quite a wide hearing within the mass media.
Yeah, reading your book, I was struck by how the 1950s were not quite the somnolent, complacent decade that some people think of it now, right?
That's exactly it, and this is the problem with seeing Mills as a loner. I mean, he doesn't come out of nowhere. He is part of certain trends within his own time, and indeed, one of Mills' own problems was that he couldn't sort of as a sociologist, he couldn't sociologically account for where he came from, and if he could have, maybe he would have seen certain trends that ran against the sort of Cold War consensus of that period.
I'm speaking with Daniel Geary, author of Radical Ambitions, a new book on C. Wright Mills from the University of California Press. Well, this sort of leads to where Mills went next. Since the late 50s were not the time of torpor that people think of it in retrospect, it's not all that much of a surprise that the new left was going to emerge several years later, and Mills was an important part of that. Talk to us a bit about Mills' role in the emergence of a new left and the role he played in that.
Well, the important thing about this is that it's not primarily an American story for Mills. In fact, he goes abroad for the first time in 1956. He has a Fulbright year, and he discovers the new left in Britain, and then discovers it as well in Eastern Europe among certain dissident communist intellectuals. And then he comes back to the U.S. and tries to see if a new left can be built there, in particular on the basis of an international peace movement that was increasing in strength during this period. You had the formation of SANE in the U.S. in 1958, and of course the CND in Britain, which has similar anti-nuclear politics. So there was a sort of a new space for radicalism already in the mid to late 1950s, and Mills was very much a part of that. And it actually was Mills who first took this term New Left, a term that the British New Left has borrowed from French intellectuals, and used it in the American context. So part of the reason we call the American New Left the New Left is because of Mills, and he writes this famous letter to the New Left of 1960, which is widely publicized in the U.S., although published initially in the New Left Review in Britain.
A British journal, and of course he was also kind of associated with the Frankfurt School people who actually, Marcuse, for example, became a popular figure in the 60s.
Absolutely. There are close connections between Mills and Marcuse and their sort of social analysis as well as their role as important figures for sort of young intellectuals of the New Left, although Mills was dead by 1962, so he wasn't around really to see the full emergence of a New Left.
But those Frankfurt guys were, at least in the early generation, pretty pessimistic. And Mills, of course, as we were talking earlier, was pretty pessimistic. Did any of these developments, late 50s and early 60s, shake any of his pessimism?
I think it did shake his pessimism. He began to be more optimistic about, and the interesting thing here is a replacement of labor as a sort of agency for social change. Mills became interested in the idea that what he called a cultural apparatus, in a sense, the sort of middle class, teachers, students, people who worked in the cultural industries themselves, that these sort of people, which he saw in part, and this was the basis for peace activism, for instance, in Britain and the U.S., and Mills argued that this class could be an important force for radical social change, as well as, and we haven't talked about Cuba yet, but as well as third world revolutionaries like the Cuban revolutionaries, he also thought could be a sort of a force of social change.
Yeah, he paid a visit to Cuba right after the revolution, right, 1960, and wrote a famous essay about that. What was the message of that?
Well, this book he wrote, Listen Yankee, was a series of letters written as if he was a Cuban revolutionary, sort of explaining the Cuban Revolution. Mills was very excited about the Cuban Revolution. At the time, of course, Castro was not a communist. Mills had always been a sort of an anti-Stalinist leftist. And so part of the appeal of the Cuban Revolution was that for Mills it was revolutionary socialism, but not connected to communism. And of course, when Castro moves to communism, there's a lot of evidence that Mills was very disappointed by that. But Mills also wanted to make a sort of a strong point about American foreign policy and the sort of injustice and idiocy of American foreign policy toward Cuba.
As you pointed out, he was never part of any kind of political organization, really. He did work with the labor movement, but he wasn't really formally part of it. He might not have even ever gone to a political demonstration. What was his view of the role of the intellectual? It was some sort of isolated figure who just wrote books? Or how does an intellectual fit in with a model of radical political change?
Well, it depends on which phase you're talking about. If you talk about the labor movement phase, and Mills had the idea that intellectuals could help out the working class, that they could play sort of a pivotal role in articulating the political aspirations of the union movement. When the union movement disappears, then Mills has the idea that the intellectual is sort of the only figure around who's capable of resisting the pernicious social trends that he identified. But by the late to early 1960s, Mills came to have the idea that intellectuals themselves, if you conceived of intellectuals in a wider sense as a sort of cultural apparatus, that is to say, anyone who has anything to do with the sort of shaping or distribution or reception of ideas, then you get a much wider class of people. And he believed that this class of intellectuals, in a sense, could be a force for social change in and of themselves.
How?
Well, this was a problem. It was an important theory that did lead, in fact, to important intellectual and cultural changes that did challenge the Cold War consensus. But on the other hand, how this was supposed to translate into institutional political change was a problem. And Mills, in this sense, didn't see the real differences between, say, Cuban revolutionaries who had seized state power by violent means and a broad class of intellectuals in the Western world who would have to ally with other groups if they were going to make institutional political change.
You said earlier, and you say in the book, that he was not as profoundly at odds with many of the dominant liberalism of the period as he sometimes thought. What did you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by this is that if you look at their evaluations of the political order that was shaped after 1945, the evaluations are quite different. I mean, Mills is a very strong critic, whereas liberals are supporters of it. But if you look at their descriptions of it, they have many similarities in common. In particular, liberals perceive what they saw as the end of ideology. This was a famous phrase used a lot in the mid to late 1950s. Daniel Bell writes a book in 1960 on the end of ideology. And the idea...
Some of that published in a journal sponsored by the CIA, right?
That's right. You had the Congress for Cultural Freedom and Encounter magazine. So there was a project here of trying to ally moderate anti-communist social democrats in Western Europe with liberals in the United States. But they basically believed that this sort of mixed post-New Deal economy had solved the important questions of industrial capitalism. And for that reason, there was no longer any need for radical ideology, which simply had come to an end, at least in the Western world. And ironically, Mills, in the mid-1950s as well, though Mills decried the situation, he perceived a very similar situation. He believed that even that class issues had been sort of effectively suppressed via the Society of Affluence after this period, and that there were no forces for social change. And both liberals and Mills, for this reason, failed to predict the emergence of both left-wing and right-wing challenges to that Cold War consensus in the 1960s.
It's remarkable that Mills is a very influential figure. People, I think the power elite is still in print and sells very heavily after more than 50 years. Yet he didn't reach the age of 50. How did this man, in such a short period of time, create such a substantial body of work and a substantial influence?
Well, I think he was a very hard worker. He was... Had a sort of incredible energy about him, was quite driven to write and to speak out about the issues of his day. So it was a short life, but it was one that was very well lived in that sense.
And finally, this Some of this end of ideology sounds a little like Francis Fukuyama of a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Now that, of course, looks a little antique, but then it seemed it was popular. But what is the relevance of this stuff that was written 40, 50, 60 years ago to the present?
Well, I think there's relevance in lots of different Mills' work. I mean, White Collar, for it does have some problems, but anyone who works in an office, I think, can read that book today and recognize some of the things that Mills was talking about. The Power Elite, you know, it's, of course, the case that corporate and military and political leaders are very much closely connected in running the country today. That hasn't changed. And if you look at his book, The Sociological Imagination, that's the 1959 book, I think remains a very inspiring account of what sociology and social thought more generally can do and the promise of that thought.
That was Daniel Geary, author of the book Radical Ambition, an intellectual biography of the great sociologist C. Wright Mills, just published by the University of California Press. Geary teaches at Trinity College in Dublin. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of the fourth movement of Beethoven's String Quartet No. 14, performed by the Juilliard Quartet. Next up, Claudia Golden. Golden is a professor of economics at Harvard and one of our leading experts on gender in the labor market. Golden, along with her Harvard colleague Lawrence Katz and Marianne Bertrand of the University of Chicago Business School, have done research into the origins of the gender gap in pay in elite professions. They did a survey of Chicago Business School alums to investigate finance and other top-earning professions. And Golden and Katz themselves have been involved in a long-term study of the work experiences of Harvard alumni. Here's Claudia Golden. Welcome, Claudia Golden. You've done some, with some colleagues, have done some very interesting work into the gender gaps in the professions and what are the causes behind them. Let's start by talking about some of the work you've done by surveying MBAs, particularly those who've gone into finance. What are the dimensions of the gender gap several years after graduation among people who look otherwise very similar?
The gender gaps are relatively large, particularly around 10 years out. I don't think that one sees gender gaps as large as these. They're what we call 60 log points, which we can think of in terms of about 50-something percent difference. These are very high-income earners, so no one's crying about anyone in this group, but these differences are quite large.
And so let's talk about some of the possibilities of why this is. Are there any differences in their school backgrounds to start with?
There aren't too many differences in their backgrounds. Before they went to the University of Chicago, they're all University of Chicago MBAs. They have taken different types of courses to some degree, and adding those into the mix of explanatory variables closes the gap somewhat, but that isn't an important part of the explanation.
All right, then what about the kinds of work they do? Any differences that you can tell on that?
Well, there are differences. The big differences are that women tend to work somewhat fewer hours, and they tend to take off more time. Now, the differences are not enormously large. If you were to look at them, you would say these women are working really long hours.
Yeah, the hours you report are enormous. Was 74 hours a week in investment banking?
Right, but that's for the average investment banker. Women are disproportionately not in investment banking. Women are disproportionately in fields like human resources, in which hours are somewhat shorter. Men are disproportionately in investment banking, that's right. But the differences between men and women, both in terms of hours and job experience in the corporate and the financial world, whereas they're low, the penalties for not working continuously and for not putting in relatively long hours are relatively large. And so those two factors go a far way in explaining this very large gap.
And that time off, is that about children?
It's generally about, I mean, we ask, is it about health? Is it about job dissatisfaction? Is it about family? So it can be about children, which it generally is, but it's also the case that women without children take off more time for family matters, in part because they're taking care of their parents or other loved ones.
And is there any evidence that the women who take off time to have children have either been withdrawing from work or dissatisfied with their jobs, or they look any different before they have the kids and take the time off?
That's a very good question, and we did look into that. Our data is rich enough so that we can do that, and we find, to the contrary, that in general, they're doing quite well. So, in other words, we're not looking at individuals who are drawn from below, let's say, the mean in the distribution.
And what about, are women MBAs in general more likely or less likely than male MBAs to have children?
They're going to be less likely. In this sample, in particular, far fewer were married when they were MBAs. Far fewer were married 10 years out. Fewer have children.
And what about the impact on men of having, I know I've read elsewhere that when men have kids, their salaries go up. Is this true among MBAs?
In general, that's a robust finding almost everywhere. And we can see in some extremely rich data where we can follow individuals before they have kids and after they have kids, that it's pretty much that men tend to work more intensely. You can say they're sort of running faster to make certain that the family has a really good income. In this sample, I don't think that the difference was that great. These are really high-income earners anyhow.
Is it mostly about kids, or you said other reasons for family care? Is having kids the predominant reason that women take off?
That is the predominant reason. In that particular survey, we didn't ask exactly whether it was kids or whether it was parents, but you can see that even women who don't have kids are taking time off for, quote, family matters.
Taking care of an elderly parent or something.
Yeah. So in this sample, we can look at women right after they've had a child and follow them for several years out. And what we find here is that immediately after having a kid, the differences between men and women actually aren't that great. They sort of kick in something like 2 years later. So it's as if these are high-performing, very smart, very energetic, highly competitive individuals as well. And so it may be that after having their first kid, they come back and they say, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to have it all. I'm going to put it all together. And then 2 years out, it becomes very difficult. And this, of course, let me add, isn't necessarily true of everyone, but it's true of enough so that we can see on average these relatively large differences.
What are the effects of having multiple kids? Is it just having any kid at all that's the big difference, or is just having a series make things make the gaps even wider?
Yeah, that we certainly thought that we would see with the second kid a very large negative shock to the women's employment and income. But it turns out that it's really having any kids and with the, not that the second one doesn't matter, but the big difference is something like 2 or 3 years out after having the first kid. We thought that 2 or 3 years out was the second kid, but it turns out that in these very rich data, we don't see that it's the second kid. It seems as if even those women who don't have a second kid, that the first kid at 2 years old, that there's a tendency for women to want to slow down at that point.
What, if any, effects do husbands' earnings have on women's behavior and ultimate earnings?
They have a very large effect. In this survey, we have information on husbands' education and husbands' earnings contemporaneously. And so it's sort of a weak test. But the test shows very clearly that that even among these rather high flyers, that having a husband with a lot more income does make a very large difference and does lead women to slow down a bit more.
You have a striking finding that the penalty for men who take time off is even harsher for that for women, right?
It's a little bit more. Of course, the two problems. One is that the sample size of men who are taking time off is pretty small. And the second one is that it's quite possible that there are other intervening factors that we're not capturing. But I would say that the differences are about the same. And so it's not as if women are being penalized for being women. They're being penalized for deviating from the norm.
Well, also just these are fields where taking any time off is damaging to your career, isn't it?
It certainly does seem that way, but there are lots of other fields, equally prestigious, paying quite a lot, in which the damage isn't as great. So
yep.
I would say that these are fields in which there isn't a lot of forgiveness on the part of the corporate sector.
Yeah, I want to get to that in just a second, but I just one final question. How much should we care about what happens to women in finance and similar professions? Is this a matter that social policy should be terribly worried about, or is they so high-earning that we should just shrug our shoulders and say, too bad?
I think we should be worried about equal treatment anywhere, and to the extent that this system has been set up in such a way that there is an equal treatment, I think that we should care. But on the other hand, I do agree that this wouldn't be high up on my list of discrimination problems to the extent that someone might claim it's discrimination. It wouldn't be high up on that list to do something about.
I'm speaking with Claudia Golden, who is an economist at Harvard University. All right, let's talk about some of the other research you did. What we were just talking about was drawn on from a survey of University of Chicago Business School graduates. You've also been involved with a survey of Harvard graduates that's been following them for several decades. Tell us about that work.
So that work begins with a sample of Harvard College students. Most of whom graduated, and they would have attended Harvard in the late 60s to the early 1990s. We don't follow them in the sense that this isn't a truly longitudinal survey, but we have information about them over time, and we did a survey of them in 2006.
Okay, and you find that finance is about the most punishing of their professions, right?
That's right. Precisely, which is why we then did the University of Chicago MBA survey.
What other fields are not quite so punishing?
Well, at the other extreme is the MDs. So most of the...
Which would be a surprise, because you think MDs work very, very hard.
MDs certainly work very hard, and we're very thankful for it. But it turns out that... that many MDs, many of whom are women, and in fact, about 50% of individuals who are working to get their MD right now are women. And of the MDs below the age of 35, about 40-something percent are women. In certain fields, there are far more women than in other fields. So, for example, in family practice and psychiatry and immunology, in pediatrics, the fraction female is very high. In the surgical specialties, it's incredibly low, very, very low. And so those are the specialties which are what you were saying are the more punishing specialties. Those are the specialties in which you have to be on call X days a week. So those are the ones that are not as compatible with having a family. In the other specialties, physicians often work 4 days a week. or they might work regular hours but not have on-call hours, or have on-call hours every so often. So in fact, there is a considerably more flexibility, interestingly enough, in most of the MD specialties than in the corporate sector.
And what about law?
Law tends to be sort of in between. It's there are big law firms, there are small law firms, there's being corporate counsel, there's working for the government. So there's the ability to sort of put together, pick and choose what you want. Now, that said, working in a large corporate law firm is going to be more remunerative than working for the government or being corporate counsel.
Now, and David Leonhardt's article about this in the Times the other day, he points out that obstetrics is a field where you think that the doctor doesn't have that much control over his or her time because the baby comes on his or her own calendar. But on the other hand, there doesn't seem to be that much of a penalty. Well, how does that work out?
Well, there are many fields. Anesthesiology is one, radiology is one, in which doctors work in groups. And when you have a surgery, for example, you pick your surgeon. But the anesthesiologist in general is being chosen by the surgeon. And it will be an anesthesiology group. So whether it be Dr. X, Y, or Z depends upon who's available at that moment. But you're going to schedule your surgery so that you have that surgeon. You're not taking a surgeon at random. And the same thing in obstetrics. It's more like anesthesiology. On the other hand, it's sort of in between because perhaps there are four obstetricians in the practice, and as a pregnant woman, you'll be going to see each one of them every so often. You get to know each of them. They get to know your case, things that are particular about it. But when you deliver, you may have one favorite one or two favorite ones. Perhaps you'll get those, but perhaps they'll be busy at that time delivering another child, and you'll get one of the others.
But no, what you're saying is that an approach to this involves group work, the organization of work. But also, are there kinds of social policies that we could implement that would also ease the burden of on women and the impact on their careers?
Well, I really haven't thought about social policy. It's not my thing. I do think, and this is the that firms themselves change their policy. That, for example, in the accounting world, in the world of CPAs, some of the big four, at least two of the big four companies, and that's Deloitte and Ernst & Young, have been on record for almost 20 years now in saying that they are going to make certain that female CPAs don't leave their firm. And they're going to do this with a set of policies. Now, why did they do this? You know, are they particularly in love with having female CPAs? No, they did it because a lot of CPAs are women. And so they were forced to change. And it may be that in the financial sector, in the corporate sector, there'll be more of a sense that you're just losing human capital. You're losing individuals who are valuable to the firm.
And I should ask you also that you've not only studied Harvard undergraduates, but you've or Harvard alumni, but you've also looked at other universities, right?
We always have to be careful because some of the people in our sample actually never did graduate from Harvard, but most of them did.
Yeah, there are a few of those.
But you've also supplemented this with surveys of graduates of other less brand-name institutions, right?
Well, let us say everything's a brand-name institution. But there are public use files created by the Census Bureau. One of them is called the National Survey of College Graduates. One version of it was done in 2003, one in 1993. They're very valuable. They're very large. Each one of them has over 100,000 individuals, and they are from birth cohorts going back to the 20s until more recently. So they're very, very large files, and we have looked at those as well.
And any significant differences between those and what you found of Harvard alums?
By and large, to the extent that we can make these comparisons, not very large differences at all.
Just a couple of other issues. One, something that came up in the press a few years ago, it was a kind of a controversy, probably not relevant so much now in the recession, but people were talking about women opting out of the labor force, particularly graduates of elite universities, a few years in the job market decided to kick back and pull out. This was a controversial finding. Do you have any thoughts on just how real this phenomenon is?
Yeah, it would be interesting if it was a, quote, controversial finding. It's controversial because it wasn't actually a finding. It was a set of anecdotes. And we don't see in this sample, because we're the individuals who are the youngest in the Harvard and Beyond survey are in their 30s today. And in looking at that group versus other groups, those who are 45 today, those who are 55 today, we don't see any differences in how much time women are taking off, conditional on their highest degree, for example, and the number of kids. We're not seeing very large differences at all. We are seeing, which is interesting, we are seeing that the younger generation of women today, those who are 35 today, are having somewhat slightly more kids. They're having them later in life, and they're bunching them together than those who graduated in the 70s when women were first struggling to make it into various professions. And so in some sense, that should make us feel better. That's something make us feel a lot more optimistic that women have become more accepted in these professions, they've become more comfortable in these professions, and therefore, in fact, they're having somewhat more kids. Are they, quote, opting out? Doesn't look like they're, if they are, quote, opting out, it doesn't look like it's any different across the cohorts that we've looked at. What about those 18-year-olds who were interviewed and they said, well, what we want to do is get a law degree, have a family, and stay at home with the kids and never use the law degree? We're certainly not seeing that in cohorts that have gotten law degrees. Do we know what 18-year-olds are actually going to do? Not until they do it.
I don't want to think about what I thought when I was an 18-year-old, so I wouldn't want to project anything out of that. And then finally, you did an interview, I think it was the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and there was an interesting passage in there where you talked about discrimination by gender. What the classic theories of discrimination by, say, race and nationality involve groups that are different. You know, people, employers might not live or near or with the group that they're discriminating against. There's an element of unfamiliarity. That does not apply to men and women who obviously live together very closely. So how do you explain the origins of that gender discrimination in contrast to the other kinds?
Absolutely right. I mean, blacks and whites, for example, can have certain animosities. They did, hopefully, that has disappeared. Jews and Palestinians, Catholics and Protestants, we see this all over the world. We don't like it, but it exists. But it's very hard to believe that men and women don't like each other. Every man I know has a mother. Most have wives. Many have sisters. They have good friends who are women. So it couldn't possibly be that they have some distaste for working with women or being in school with women and so on and so forth. There has to be something else. And what I hit upon there is something that I call the pollution theory of discrimination. And that is that it isn't so much that they don't like being around women, but that historically women weren't in certain professions. They weren't trained in certain areas. And so when a woman is a, for example, fire person or a police person, and when there hadn't been women in these positions before, it appears to signal to people that something has been degraded or polluted in those professions. And that's where this theory, how this theory was developed.
Now, there is some evidence that professions that where women are predominant actually do suffer a wage penalty, right? It's not just maybe this is not just fantasy.
It, not be just fantasy at all. But there are certain reasons one has to study each one of these cases in which women were not in a profession and then they became the majority in the profession, and ask whether that statement that you made holds up. So, for example, I'll give you a well-known case. In the 19th century, men were secretaries, the word secretary coming from being the keeper of the company's secrets. This was an individual who was a highly trusted person who knew a tremendous amount about the firm, who worked close with the president, with the owner of the firm, and possibly even with an individual who would one day become the head of the firm. Fast forward that into the 20th century with a more highly divided labor in terms of high division of labor, I should say, with typewriters and stenographers and so on and so forth. And the secretary then has a rather different position. That secretary doesn't know the full workings of the corporation in general, isn't as high up, is not someone who's going to be next in line to be the head of the corporation. So something changed in terms of the production function in the firm, the use of capital, for example, in terms of typewriters, for example, the division of labor in terms of who does what, and relative wages for that occupation plummeted. There's no question. But was it the same occupation? No, it wasn't the same occupation. Now, on the other hand, another occupation that I'm studying are veterinarians. 30 years ago, about 5-7% of all veterinarians were women. Today, the fraction of new veterinarians coming out who are female is 77%. So veterinary medicine is rapidly becoming a woman's position. Will relative wages go down because of that? I don't think so. I think that we are seeing an occupation that for various reasons is becoming more female, but it's not becoming female because intrinsically the occupation has changed in terms of the human capital that's demanded. In fact, if anything, the amount of training and human capital for veterinarians today is greater than it was 30 years ago.
Last question. If you adjust for all the things that economists typically adjust for, education, work experience, profession, all those sorts of things, and then try to isolate the pure gender gap, people who look otherwise the same on paper, but they just happen to be male versus female, if you just isolate that pure gender gap, what is the trend in that over time? Is it coming down or is it still pretty sticky?
Well, it's probably coming down in the sense that we have better data. Okay, so when we first started doing this, we had lousy data. And lousy data means that you don't have very good estimates of actual job experience. You don't have very good estimates of what courses you took in college, what your major was, what you were preparing for. You don't have very good estimates of what your home responsibilities are and so on and so forth. And so the residual gap from those data sets was pretty large. The residual gap, for example, from our MBA data, in which, as you recall, the gap in earnings was enormously large. The residual gap after we add everything in that is something that should affect your productivity, that residual gap is almost zero. It's very, very small. So we could say that the gap is going down and thus, quote, discrimination is going down. But it's hard to know whether that's because we're just doing a much better job measuring these differences. When we look at data from the 1970s and the 1980s for men versus women, we see some pretty large gender gaps. But many of those women, when they went to college, weren't preparing to go into the corporate sector, for example. They were preparing to be homemakers. They were preparing to be teachers. They were preparing to be journalists and editors. And they were taking, they were majoring in fields that didn't have the enormous market value that men were, the fields that men were majoring in. And we didn't have those data to add them to the, let's say, the statistical soup. But we do now.
All right. Thank you very much. That was Claudia Golden, who teaches in the Harvard Economics Department and who is one of the profession's leading experts on gender and work. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, new from Fisher Spooner, Supply and Demand. How economical. Till next week. Bye. Typical.